Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Camille B. from San Diego.
My name's Camille, and I'm an alcoholic, and I brought a few notes to keep myself on track. I would really like to thank everybody for inviting me to come and speak, and for the warm welcome. Made me feel a little bit like the royalty I used to talk about being when I was out in the bars drinking. I would like to welcome the newcomers. I'm so glad you're here. I hope you keep coming back. Congratulations to those birthday folks. Bobby, I haven't seen Bobby in years, and it's really good to see you. I grew up in a Catholic family, and it wasn't a drinking family at all. It was a so-called normal family. My parents would have an occasional cocktail when they played cards with the neighbors, and we would have maybe some wine on very special occasions. And my very early childhood, by all reports, I was normal, and in fact was quite an outgoing, adventuresome type child. Somewhere along the line that changed. We had a couple events in the family that the rest of the family seemed to be able to adjust and seemed to be able to move on. And although I didn't know it at the time, this is only after I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous a little while, I looked back and I realized that I was either unwilling or incapable of accepting life on life's terms. And needless to say, I turned from this outgoing, adventuresome, happy child into a withdrawn and very fearful person. Time went along, and I don't remember trying to talk to anybody about it. I don't remember anybody really noticing the change. I suspect my mother knew. Perhaps she didn't know quite what to do. I don't know. But at any rate, what I did was I just tried to do my best to do the things I thought people expected me to do and to say the things I thought was expected of me and try and hide the fact that I was so fearful and so withdrawn and all. I tried to pretend I was normal. And as the years went by, it got harder and harder and harder to pull it off. And by the time I was 17, I was in a really bad emotional place. My parents, as I said, were Catholic. I was raised Catholic, but I hadn't given up on God or anything, but I knew there was something very wrong with me, and I thought perhaps it was evil. You know, I was evil or something. And religion didn't seem, the Catholic Church didn't seem to be able to help me at all. So I'm 17. I had graduated from high school. And it's summertime, and as I said, I'm in this bad emotional state, and as much as I feel really inadequate in social situations, I felt even worse at home, and so I tried to stay away from home as much as possible, and I was hanging around with a girlfriend, and we went out one evening with some other kids, and one of them said, you know, this is boring. What we were doing was doing something called dragging mane. I don't know if anybody else has ever done that, but that was what you did where I lived. I'm huddled up in the back seat of this car, you know, all squished up against the corner, not talking, not laughing at the jokes, even the dirty ones, Al. And this boy said, you know, we were getting bored with the whole thing, and let's go by my house, and you know, I'll get a couple of bottles, and we'll turn this into a party. And I got drunk, and that was my first drunk. I didn't get sick, didn't have a hangover the next day, and I felt wonderful, actually. You know, I remember that first swig off that bottle. It was vodka, and it seemed to go down really nice, and I felt so nice and warm, and a few more swigs, I don't know how many. I'm starting to feel really relaxed. Next thing you know, boy, I'm just a party goer. You know, I'm telling the stories, and I'm laughing and dancing and carrying on and having a great time. Next day when I get up, I'm not quite that happy, not quite that relaxed, but I'm still feeling good. And I'm thinking, well, now here's the answer, you know. Now I know, I just had to get away and really relax, and now everything's okay. And it slowly wore off, but it lasted for a while. But by the next weekend, you know, I'm back in the same reality, and one of the things I did all those years was I would look at a certain date in the future, and that was the date I knew I was going to change, that all of this was going to just go away and I was going to be the real me. The real me was going to come out, and I was going to be just like the rest of my family. My birthday, you know, the next birthday, or the next Christmas, or the next New Year's, or when I started school, or when I finished school. There was always a date out there where everything was going to change. And since this, after a few drunks, and I must tell you, I always got drunk. I didn't do this, I'll have a couple of drinks, from the very beginning. A couple of drinks didn't do anything for me. I had to go all the way. I had to get good and drunk before I would get that really comfortable, nice, mellow, I'm okay feeling. So I had a few more weekends, and it would be just on Saturday night, and I don't remember how many it took before I realized, you know, that this really isn't going to work. But until that magic day comes along, you know, until I'm able to just flip this over, at least this is keeping me from, you know, going absolutely nuts. And I'm able to do some things, you know. I'm able to do some of those things that I want to do. And so that's how I lived my life for about 17 and a half years. The changes that came along were slow. It was every Saturday night for a long time. At some point, it became a couple drunks a week, three drunks a week. In that time, I didn't get sick. I only threw up twice that I remember during my whole drinking time. Once was in a bar, a little embarrassing, but, you know, I mean, I was in a bar drinking. That must have been something I ate, the peanuts or something. And one other time in a gentleman's car, and again, must have been something I ate, you know, or the pipe he was smoking or something. I started compromising a little bit of what I believed in. But there again, you know, you have to go along and change a little as you get older, is the way I looked at it. So I drank for 17 and a half years. The drunks got longer. When I first started out, when I was a teenager, we started drinking around 8:30, 9 o'clock in the evening. Moved up to, as I got older, that moved up to like 7, 8 o'clock, and then it was 6 o'clock, and then it was 4 o'clock. And then it became noon, and it was noon for a long time. Noon on my days off, and then later when I was working, a later time in the day. I never went to jail. never got picked up by the police department, didn't have my children taken away from me, did get divorced. One of the things that I thought was going to save me as when I got into my 20s was, of course, a man. I knew a man would save me. Nothing else would. I was engaged, and that went along really well until I got real drunk one night and made an absolute fool of myself, and there went that down the tubes. But I kept trying anyway. Got married, and when that marriage ended, it didn't really affect me a whole lot because I had felt like we really shouldn't have gotten married in the first place. We didn't share much in common. My second husband, however, I met him in a bar, and he drank. And he drank a little more than I drank. And it was like he was just perfect. He would understand my drinking. He'd understand, and we could drink together, and this was going to work out just fine. Across a smoky room, the bars aren't smoky like they used to be, and I think it spoils the ambience myself, but we get married. And we both continue to drink a little more, kind of at the same pace. He's drinking a little more, and I'm drinking a little more. And I get concerned about him because he's drinking more. So I start going down to the bar where we drank at this. We drank at a number of places, but this one place in particular, I'd get off work and he'd get off work, and I'd go down there and meet him, and right after work, and to keep an eye on him and to help him, make sure he didn't get into trouble, you know. And one evening, we were walking home from that place, or maybe staggering home would be a better word, and we passed this drunk laying out on a bus bench, and he was a real mess. He'd messed on himself, and he was in bad shape. And I looked at him and I said to my husband, to be helpful, of course, that if you don't slow down on your drinking a little bit, you're going to end up like that. And he got incensed. He didn't like that. And in fact, not only did he not like that, he said, you know, if you want to look at somebody's drinking, maybe you ought to look at your own. And so I got incensed. Not too long after that, we had a real fight over it, and he had to leave town on a job, and we were still having this fight when he left town, and he was gone several months. And when it came time for him to come home, I wanted to make sure that I was really ready for him. So I stocked our bar with a lot of Jack Daniels and made ready for him to come home. When he came home, he had a young lady with him. And he had decided that our marriage was not going to work. I had no faith in him. I thought he was a drunk, and so he felt that that was not right, and he was going to move on. And I won't go into all the details of that night, but that was the night of my incomprehensible demoralization. It was also the night that I started my round-the-clock drinking. I had taken off a few days from work because he was coming home and figured we'd need a few days to party. And I just drank round the clock. And when I went into work, needless to say, I wasn't in any shape to be working. And the supervisor came to me and she said, you know, Camille, you've got a real problem. And if you don't know where to go to get help for it, we do. We'll help you get help. As far as I can remember, she didn't mention the word alcohol. She didn't say, you know, go here or go there. You have to stop drinking, anything like that. But she sent me home. At first, my reaction was, well, why is she picking on me? There's this person doing that. There's that person doing that. And then I just said, well, you know, the hell with you. And I did what I had been doing all along, just continued to stay drunk. That was in late October. In fact, the day she talked to me was Halloween. Rather prophetic, if I do say so myself. So that was October of 1975. In January 1st of 1976, I crawled out from under my bed. I don't know how long I'd been there. I don't know where I had been between October and January 1st. And for the first time, I was really, really sick. I was real nauseated. I was having chills, and then I was getting really hot and just really feeling a mess. And I looked for that thought of, this is New Year's Day, and now things are going to change. I'm going to flip, you know. This is New Year's Day, and that's what's going to happen. And I couldn't even get the thought. What happened instead, and for those of you who are new, you may have experienced this yourself, and you'll hear others talk about it, that moment of clarity. I'm sitting there just sick as can be, and I'm trying to think of, you know, something hopeful. And instead, I had this real clear, clear moment. It was like every cell in my body was all on the very same thread. It was incredibly clear. And the thought that came to me was, Camille, you know, you're drinking because you've got to drink. Nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to change. Husband or no husband, you know, job or no job, kids or no kids, you're drinking because you have to drink. That's all you can do. And it really scared me. And I called somebody that I worked with. Her father was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how I knew that. I don't know if I was thinking of that when I called her. And I told her, you know, Patty, I think maybe I'm a little bit of an alcoholic. And she said, you know, there is no such thing. You're either an alcoholic. It's like being pregnant. You either are or you're not. And I'll be right over. Now, this is New Year's Day. And she came over. And first she tried to talk me into going to the hospital. And no. I know people there. No, I can't go to the hospital. And then we had a mutual friend who was a doctor, and she said, well, why don't I call so-and-so and have him come over? And no, I didn't want part of that either because, you know, it was New Year's Day and blah, blah, blah. In the meantime, she's trying to find something to give me to drink. And I didn't realize it at the time, but later she let me know that she was really afraid I was going into DTs. She was really worried about me. And what she found was some dry sack wine. And she started spoon-feeding me that. And I don't know what dry sack wine tastes like or anything. I don't remember drinking it. What I do remember is that she's feeding me this dry sack wine, and I'm starting to feel a little better. And she is telling me that pretty soon she's going to have to leave. But before she leaves, she's going to call Alcoholics Anonymous and have somebody come over. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what have I got myself into now? You know, oh, no. And so I told her, well, we don't want to bother those people. It must be so miserable for them. This is New Year's Day, and they've had to spend this holiday not partying or having any fun because they can't drink. And I can't do that to them. And she finally just gave up and left. And we made an agreement that I believe it was that was a Friday, if I remember right, and we made an agreement that on the 19th, which was Monday, that I would go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with her. I don't know why there was that span of days in there, but I do know I had some Valium that I was taking liberally. For some reason, we set the date as the 19th. When she left, what happened? Oh, I need to back up. I kind of missed a spot. That was on the 1st. She left. I went out. I don't know where I went, but I was out, really out. And came back on the 16th. That's what it was. Came back on the 16th, called her to go to a meeting or whatever. And that's when she told me that I had called her several times while I was out there arranging to go to meetings, and she'd come to pick me up and I wouldn't be there. And so she wanted me to not drink for a day or two, and then she would take me to this meeting and all. That's why we did the 19th senior moment. Anyway, the 19th came, and one of the things that I got up and I realized that I couldn't wait for her. That if I didn't go right that second, you know, I knew I was going to drink. And when I had come home on the 16th, one of the things that had occurred to me was that I just couldn't seem to be doing this anymore. You know, it was just getting to be too much. And I had decided that what I really needed to do was just end it all. I was going to commit suicide. And the reason it was so important for me to now go to Alcoholics Anonymous, where I couldn't wait to get there, you know, was because I knew if I was going to successfully kill myself, I would have to not drink. I had, those years I'd been out there, I'd done a couple of these really silly, stupid things, and I would tell people I was going to do it, you know, and they'd try and stop me and, you know, that kind of thing. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only reason I really came was to buy some time to put a plan together to kill myself. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to not drink long enough to kill myself because I couldn't stop drinking. And when they talked about the insanity in the second step, I didn't think it applied to me. So that day, I knew where the Alcoholics Anonymous office was. I had gone by it numerous times on my way to work. And so I got on a bus, and I went to Central Office, which at that time was on 4th Avenue. And kind of walked around for a little while and finally went in. And there were a couple of little dried-up old ladies sitting behind a counter. And I just loved it. I never dreamed I'd be one of them. I did the same thing. I told them I thought maybe I had a little trouble with drinking. And this one lady said, well, what makes you think that? And I wavered back and forth. I exaggerated to think I really... make them think I really had a real, real, real bad problem. But then that kind of scared me. So then I backtracked and, well, no, you know, I really don't have much of a problem at all. It's really my husband, that kind of thing. And what this lady did was she gave me a copy of the 20 questions and took me downstairs, gave me a pencil and said, here, you know, maybe this will help you figure out whether you're an alcoholic or not, because I can't tell you you are. It's something you need to decide for yourself. And then later that day, the other little dried up old lady took me to a meeting at Pathfinders. and I don't remember much of that meeting of all at all, except those slogans they had up on the wall. And I looked at those and I thought, oh my God, that's the kind of stuff my mother used to say. And that didn't work, and I don't think this is going to work either. After the meeting was over, the lady took me by the hand and she led me into Kenny's office. And Kenny was, anybody, you remember Kenny, Bobby? Kenny was a little guy, and he's sitting behind this big desk, and this lady says to him, this girl wants to buy a book. Book, you know. But, you know, I need to not drink for a little while anyway. You know, I've got this plan, and I have to not drink. And if it means nodding my head that, yeah, I want a book, when I don't even know what the book is, okay. Kenny gave me the book, I gave him a bad check, and we left. And and I have since made that check good. My sponsor pointed out it is an honest program, and so and then I went home, and I have this book, and I'm in my room, and I know if I step outside the door of my room, I'm going to drink. You know, I just know it. I've still got my Valium, and I'm trying hard not to drink, and I try to read this book, and I don't know how many times I tried. The only thing that made any sense to me at all was in the doctor's opinion, where it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect. And it talks about the restlessness, irritability, and discontent. Somebody else knows that. And that was me. When I wasn't drinking, that was me. And I thought, oh, my God, somebody else knows. It didn't, like, a big light bulb go on or anything like that. It made that impression on me, and then it was gone. But it was, I think, perhaps the very tiniest beginning of maybe a little bit of hope. There was a woman that was coming to pick me up that had been arranged when I was at central office to come and pick me up for a meeting that evening, and she took me to Mission Hills Monday night. And I remember going up that long, long flight of stairs, and the room was pink, and I was feeling kind of nauseated, and that pink didn't help any. And we sat next to a pole, and I thought, you know, that's how much these people think of me. They sit me next to this pole. But what I did was I kind of inched my way behind the pole, trying to hide. And I don't remember really anything of that meeting either. And in fact, I don't remember much of a lot of the meetings I went to in the very beginning. That group and a lot of other people I met in my first few days, the things I do remember, they kept telling me, you know, keep coming back, keep coming back. That lady that picked me up and took me to that meeting, she said it's highly recommended that you attend 90 meetings in 90 days. And I did that, and in fact did a few more because whenever I had a day off, and especially when I had a weekend off, I would try and go to a daytime meeting at Pathfinders and then a night meeting. And for my first, 4 or 5 years, I had almost a set schedule. Monday night Mission Hills, which became my home group, that is where I got the foundation for my sobriety. I firmly believe that. It was a group of people who believed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined in the book, and they had made no bones about telling you if they didn't think you were doing it right. And yet, on the other hand, they were very kind. I went Tuesday night. There was a church on Georgia Street that I went to not as regularly. I mean, I did other meetings on Tuesday night, but I went there fairly regularly. But Wednesday night was always the War Memorial Building. And then Thursday night was girls' night out. I'd go to the Thursday night young people's meeting, and that was my social life for a lot of years in my sobriety. During the first 90 days, I still had this plan. You know, the whole idea was to get back to work, get enough money together to put my kids on a plane, send them to my brother, who would take care of them, rent a nice, clean motel room, and do myself in. I had it all planned out. And I was just buying time to put it into action. When I got my 90-day token, it occurred to me, here I am, 90 days. I haven't had a drunk for 90 days. Maybe, just maybe, it's possible. And that's the first time I really remember being truly hopeful, hopeful that there was another way. But I knew if, in fact, I was going to be able to do it, I would have to do it the way these people were telling me. And so I decided, all right, I'll give this a good try. I can put the other plan on the back burner. It doesn't mean I can't do it if this doesn't work. I asked that lady who had picked me up and take me to that meeting to be my sponsor. Her name was Gail W. Bobby knows her. She was a very kind, she was very soft with me for the most part. But when she needed to get through to me, she knew how to do it. A couple instances, she had taken me to that first meeting on Tuesday night at Georgia Street. And that meeting, it was like in a theater kind of an arrangement where the seats were on this steep incline and the podium was down at the bottom, and they called on this young girl. Now, this is my third AA meeting. They called on this young girl to talk, and when she got, took her a while to get down there in the first place, and when she got down there, she had a real hard time talking, and she spaced her words out, and she'd say, my name, you get the idea. After the meeting, I said to my sponsor, she wasn't my sponsor then. I said to Gail, I said, you know, you people are really cruel. I said, they made that poor girl get up. They obviously know her, and they make her get up and talk when she can hardly talk. And she said, well, it's like this. Maybe she really needs to talk. And maybe you need to learn a little patience and tolerance. I firmly believe that my sobriety is a gift from God, that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And there's lots of reasons I believe that. But me standing there and having her say that to me, and me not blowing up, not saying to her, heck with this, you can't talk to me that way, not doing what I ordinarily would have done, is one of the miracles in my sobriety. Because I got in the car, I didn't respond. I didn't really think she was right, of course, but I didn't argue with her or anything. Another time that comes to mind, I'm not sure how sober I was, but it was sometime within the first year of my sobriety, and we were at Monday Night Mission Hills, and I was called on to talk, and I was telling everybody about how rough I was having it, you know. God, my kids were, you know, a mess, and the job, and, you know, all these things going on. And lady that talked after me said, well, you know, Camille, maybe what you need to do is you ought to get together with some friends and go out for lunch. You need to relax a little bit, so go out for lunch. And my sponsor said, Camille's been out to lunch long enough. She needs to. And nobody in that meeting called her on it either. They never said you can't treat a newcomer like that. so she was just right for me. And there again, you know, another miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous. She never told me I had to do something. She made a lot of strong suggestions. And if she suggested something that she wasn't quite sure she could do, she'd let me know. I don't know if I could do this, but I believe this is what you need to do. She didn't give me advice on, well, one time she gave me advice on my kids, but that's a whole nother story. For the most part, she didn't, you know, give me advice on what to do with my kids or what to do with the boss at work or anything like that. Everything was, you know, it says in the book. Frequently we would go to her sponsor if she wasn't quite sure what I should be doing. When I was about 5 years sober, she moved away, and I kept in touch with her, and she continued to be my sponsor for a lot of years, and then I lost track of her. And now I use another person on the program. We've got similar sobriety, and we sponsor each other back and forth. That little grain of hope I got when I was at my 90 days, the way that I helped that to grow, or actually the way God helped that to grow, was through working the 12 steps of an Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor said that if, in fact, I was going to work with her, that was one thing she did require. We would do the 12 steps, and we would do them the way they were outlined in the book. And we started out on that. And step one, admitting I was an alcoholic, I had no problem admitting I was an alcoholic, but that my life was unmanageable in spite of everything. I laugh at it now. I think, my God, how could you ever really think your life was manageable, you know, coming in like you did, the mess that you were? But, of course, you see when you're ready to see. And every once in a while, it still occurs to me, you know, I'm responsible. I need to take care of myself. Well, that is true to a certain extent. I'm responsible for the actions I take. I'm responsible for going to work, you know, and those kinds of things. I'm not responsible for the results, however. And when I think of managing my life, I think of, you know, managing it to make it come out this way. And I forget that that's not my power. We worked got through that step. Step three, we did just like it's in the book. We got down on our knees. And quite frankly, looking back on it, I don't think I really had a full understanding of what I was doing. But if I had waited till I thought I really understood it, if I'd waited till I was ready to be doing these things, I wouldn't be here tonight. I'm one of those people that, you know, I can procrastinate from now to eternity, and I can give you real good reasons that I shouldn't be doing something. I can justify anything. I'm not as good at it as I used to be, thank God, but I can still do it. And so, you know, waiting till I was ready would not have worked with me. The fourth and the fifth, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about their fourth and their fifth step, and I won't go into a lot of detail on that for me, because my experience wasn't much different than a lot of other people. I did expect what I'd heard people talk. I expected when I did that fifth that, you know, it would be this big relief, but I didn't feel that. I was glad to get it done, and I felt better, but I can't say that, you know, it was like a big rock being lifted off of my shoulders. To me, it seemed like now I've got some real work ahead of me. You know, now's when we get down to the nitty-gritty here. And we continued with the rest of the steps. If it hadn't been for my sponsor, Gail, and for the people in Monday Night Mission Hills, I never would have made it. I came so close. When I was about 8 months sober, I was standing at a bus stop. I didn't have a car, and I was tired and hungry, and hear these people, they talk about, you know, they'll do anything for you, but I'm going to take a bus home. Nobody's going to give me a ride. Of course, I didn't ask anybody for a ride, but... And I'm standing out at this bus stop, and it's kind of cold, and I'm lonely, and, you know, the whole thing. And the pour me a drink. I'm standing out there, and across the street is a bar with the door open, and they're playing country music. And, oh, how I love to drink the country music. I was a bar drinker for the majority of my days of getting drunk. I loved getting drunk in country western bars especially. They're playing this country western music, and I start off across the street. And it's just like a magnet drawing me. And I get halfway across the street, and I pause for a moment. And I say I did it, but, you know, it really wasn't me. It just really wasn't me. And then another miracle happened in my life. For whatever reason, I turned and I ran up the street. There was a club up the street. And I wasn't a member, so I couldn't go inside, but I sat down on the steps. And there was a young woman came out of that club, brought me a cup of coffee, and she sat with me there on those steps. And she let me talk, and she let me moan and groan and pity myself and, you know, and all the stuff, and she let me talk it out until we both felt it was safe enough for me to go home, that I would be able to get home without stopping to take a drink. I never want to come that close to a drink again. I don't want to have to go through the drunks, but even more, I don't want to have to go through that first year of sobriety again, because it was no picnic. And I've heard people, a lot of people talking about their first year, and certainly there are people who've had a far worse time than I have had, a far worse time. But coming to and, you know, getting feelings back and facing reality. Even today, the way I look at reality is that the problem with it is it's so damn daily, you know. Just always there. And if it weren't for the grace of God in this this program, I would have no way of living with it. This program has given me several things. One of them, which I've touched upon, is hope. You know, the hope, always the hope. I've never lost it since that 90 days when I got that little seed. No matter how bad things get, down in here, not up here, because the things up here don't count. Not in my world. But down in here, I know that no matter how bad it gets, if I don't take that first drink, at least I stand a chance. And I didn't stand a chance at all when I first got here. And I've come a little ways in learning how to live life on life's terms. When I was deciding that I would try this Alcoholics Anonymous thing, they used to talk a lot about it being a part of your life or being a way of life. And for me, I've had to make it a way of life. It can't be just a part of my life. For it to work for me, it's had to become a part of my life. During that first year, one of the things, one of the tools I caught on to was saying the Serenity Prayer. I'd say that Serenity Prayer over and over and over and over and over again. And I wasn't necessarily paying attention to it, but while I was saying the Serenity Prayer, at least I wasn't thinking about drinking or killing myself. Today, I'm pretty happy in my life. I fit in the skin that I'm in. I still have my problems, but as a lot of people will tell you, as you get more sober, the quality of your problems changes, and that's what's happened with me. I just don't have some of those problems. I don't have near the fear that I had. I still have some. It still interferes with my life at times, but it's not anywhere near like it was when I got here. And I've learned how to laugh at myself. I've learned how to look at myself. I'm able to admit that sometimes I'm wrong. Not very often, but sometimes I'm wrong. And I owe it all of it to the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. For those of you who are new, I truly hope you keep coming back. This program, really, I can tell you that it is possible to stay sober one day at a time for over 31 years, no matter what happens. We need you. If it weren't for newcomers and their new ways of looking at things, I might be stuck in some of my old ways. For all of you who are not newcomers, but are approaching old-timers, I'm grateful for all of you, too, and for what you share, your experience, your strength, and your hope with me, because that's where I get it from. And I would wish every single one of you one more day of continuous sobriety. Thank you very much.